Hello and welcome to Podcast by the Peer, the podcast where freelance copywriters talk about all things freelancing and copywriting. Whether you're a seasoned copywriter or just dipping your toe into the world of words, pull up a deck chair and join us as we dive into the minds of some of our freelance favourites. I'm your host, Tom Davies, a freelance copywriter based in Brighton. And today I'm joined by writer and mother, the language lover, and the author of Survival Skills for Freelancers, and one other. It's the grammar goddess herself, Sarah Townsend. Welcome to the show, Tara.
What an intro. That might be an all-time favourite, Tom. Thank you.
Okay, right then. Freelance myth busting. That is the focus for today's episode. Or more specifically, is freelance life all it's cracked up to be? Or do we collectively create this misleading illusion is the best thing since Scrabble? We'll find out. But before we do, Sarah, can you tell our listeners who you are and how you became a freelance copywriter?
Yeah, of course. I'm Sarah Townsend, and I became a freelance copywriter back in 1999 in the pre-social media era. There was barely any internet when I started out. So yeah, different times. And I've been doing it for 24 years, so I must enjoy it. And before that, I was working for a publishing company, magazine publishing company, who published the customer magazines, like the sort of thing. I don't even know if Tesco do it. I don't shop in Tesco anymore. But you know, the stuff that you pick up in shops, lifestyle features and recipes and this sort of thing. I used to be in control of three different brands. And before that, I worked for a financial services company called Eagle Star. And before that, I worked in financial services, just admin, because I've just done that entire thing backwards. I don't know why I did that. But anyway, I did my A-levels and I didn't want to go to uni, even though all my friends were going off to uni. I really didn't want to do it. I just wanted to get out and start earning money and experiencing life. So that's what I did. And long time later, I just fell into freelance life. I never had any plans to become a freelancer. I never had any big aspirations of running my own business. It just happened. I became pregnant with my daughter, who's now 24. And yeah, I didn't want to be doing the commute down to Bristol every day with a baby in nursery here in Gloucester. So it seemed like the perfect solution to a flexible career to fit around parenting.
Wow, and it's interesting you say that you just fell into freelancing. Some of my previous guests are the same. I think that's just a general thing, actually, in freelancing generally. Like, you don't hear a 16-year-old say, when I leave school, I'm going to become a freelance copywriter.
It doesn't happen.
I know. Well, it's great to have you on the show, Sarah. So today's topic is about busting some freelance myths, and we're going to break it into three sections, namely, number one, freelance life is easy. Number two, every day should be a good day. And three, once I have enough experience, failure won't bother me. Now, before we continue, listener, you can find Sarah's in-depth response to these myths in her brilliant book, Survival Skills for Freelancers, Tried and Tested Tips to Help You Ace Self-Employment Without Burnout. So, Sarah, should we get myth busting?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So, myth one, freelance life is easy. And I don't know about you, Sarah, but freelance life for me is very much an existence of ups and downs, lefts and rights. For me, I don't actually think modern mediums such as social media help to dispel myths that freelance life is easy. I don't know. I guess the idea comes from, if I portray this image of how easy freelance life is, I'm obviously a safe pair of hands who has my ducks in a row. I'm easy to work with. I don't know. That's just one of my theories. But what would you say to that? Would you say that freelance life is easy?
Freelance life is definitely not easy. And I don't think what happens on social media, everybody going, oh, hey, I had a record week last week. There's one particular culprit on Instagram who I've got to the stage where I'm just thinking of blocking, because it's not helpful to tell people how much you're earning. I mean, maybe it is to a certain degree, because it's important to have aspirations and it's important to want to see a clear path for your business. You want to know, okay, so I'm just starting out, but in a year from now, I'd like to have 5 regular clients. I'd like to have 2 clients on retainer. And I would like to have a bit of a stronger personal brand than I have now. For example, whatever floats your boat. So, Brighton methodology. What the hell was I thinking? So, yeah, no, I think one of the biggest myths, and I'm wobbling here because I honestly can't remember what this chapter related to, because there are so many ways in which freelance life isn't easy. And I think the biggest myth is that when you work a day in your life, when you do a job you love, you'll never work a day in your life. I think that's quite harmful, because when we are doing a job we love, and generally speaking, we do become freelance copywriters because we love the writing, we want to do more of it. But in all honesty, what we don't often take into consideration is the fact that so much of what we're doing in our day-to-day work, take a typical freelance week, you're not spending 90% of your time writing. If only, right? If you've got your ducks in a row, as you just mentioned, then maybe you've got to a stage where you've been doing this for long enough that you feel comfortable outsourcing the things you don't enjoy doing. And if you've got to that stage, that's great, because that has freed you up a shed load of time and headspace to focus on doing the work that you love. Playing with the words, the stuff we all get out of bed for. We don't get out of bed to do our own accounts. We don't get out of bed to do our admin, because we just love processes. We just love putting together proposals. That's all the stuff that we really don't like doing, generally. Most of us, hands up, I certainly don't. And we often don't realize how much of that is involved in becoming a freelancer. And because there is no typical week, it's difficult to predict what else you're going to need to be turning your hand to on any given week. But I think the mental health side of it is what really comes out with this section, because when we've got those people out there going, whoa, I'm living this nomadic dream of I can work from wherever I like, I can travel the world and work on the beach with my laptop. Great, good for you. But that is not reality for most people. Most of us, we have the ups and downs, the highs and lows, the peaks and troughs, whatever you want to call it. There are a lot of challenges involved in freelancing. And really that kind of polished, you never work a day in your life, it just holds us up to this unachievable standard of thinking, God, well, I can't complain. I'm doing what I loved and I set everything up so that it would be something that I'd love doing, but I'm still having the occasional bad day and I'm still struggling with my mental health, or I'm still struggling with the isolation that can so often come with freelancing. Because when we are working for ourselves, we are quite often isolated in our own little offices, but I think it's the first chapter of the book that says going solo doesn't mean going it alone.
Yeah, you're right. And there's so many questions I want to ask you out of that response. To kind of jog your memory about the chapter, is freelance life easy? There's one really kind of standout line for me. And it's when you're talking about money and you say, it's hard to identify the fear of having no money. And I think ultimately that's why I'll never find this gig easy, because even if you do have a bit of a financial blanket, you still worry, don't you, naturally, where is my next job coming from?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that thing that kind of drives us to, I mean, the book is very much about finding your balance. A lot of people say when you're working for yourself, there is no balance, but I disagree. I think there's a lot to be said for setting clear boundaries around what you need as an individual. And being able to do that requires a really strong understanding of yourself. And sometimes that comes with time. I was 28 when I started as a freelancer, I didn't know what I needed. I just thought, oh, I need a bit of money so I can, a bit of work and therefore a bit of money so I can maintain this nice lifestyle and have quality time with my family. I was married back then. And yeah, I was lucky that my husband at the time had a steady job as well. And I think now my household income is my income. So now I've got to the stage where I love that financial independence, but it would have freaked me the F out before because the thought of everything that comes in, you know, it makes you give off this aura of desperation. And that is, it's like a client repellent. Desperation has the opposite effect. You know, you're kind of like, oh, give me work. I need the work. I need the work. Your best position to be in is when you have that confidence that more work will come. It sounds woo to say that there have been so many instances in my freelance career where I have just had to trust the process, trust the universe. And the more you can let go of that fear of where is the next job coming from, and this is easier said than done, but it does come with practice. When you have that feeling of, oh my gosh, I don't have enough, that feeling of scarcity, it multiplies because, you know, I'm sounding really woo today. I don't know where this is coming from, but I do believe in this stuff, that you get more of what you focus on. So if you want more luck, you focus on being a lucky person. If you want to be more successful, you focus on the success that you've already achieved and you become like a magnet for those things. So if you want more work, the last thing you should focus on is the scarcity. I don't have enough, because I believe that what happens is you get more of that lack. It's mirrored everywhere because you're putting out the wrong energy into the world. And when you have the confidence to actually go, okay, this is a gift, this quiet time, this free time, this is the chance for me to work on elevating my business. This is where I set up processes or automations for some of the stuff that I don't like doing. This is where I look deep into my figures and start thinking, can I afford to outsource some of this stuff? And realistically, can you afford not to? Because if you're spending so much of your working week doing the accounts or the admin or the stuff that drains you, you're going to get to the end of the working week feeling like, wow, I feel a bit shit because all I've done is the stuff that I don't enjoy doing. This was not my dream for freelance life. This isn't what I thought it was going to be like. I thought I was going to be spending all this time working. I'm not even any good at this stuff. I'm no good at admin. I'm no good at accounts. So the quicker you can see your way clear to outsource, you're freeing up so much more than just time. It's headspace, it's confidence, it's so empowering to be spending more of your week doing the stuff you love. I feel like, Tom, I've honestly gone off about a million different tangents there. I don't even know if we closed the loop on that original thought. Probably not. But yeah, hopefully it's still helpful.
No, I agree with everything you just said. I think we can safely say that we've dispelled that myth, though, that freelance life is easy, right?
I can say so. I could just talk all morning about why freelance life isn't easy. But the thing is also, I think it's worth saying that while we acknowledge the challenges of freelance life, once you've got the tools and the skills and the knowledge and the understanding and the experience, but you can still make a really good solid start with this book and the advice in this book, because it's not just my voice. It's not just my 20 years of experience you're getting. You're also getting stories, quotes, case studies from 100 other freelancers. So it's like a hive mind. You're getting all this valuable information that can help you when you're starting out. It can give you confidence when you've been doing it for a while, but you're wobbling, and it can help you free up the mindset for growing, scaling up your business if that's the way you want to go, by spending time thinking about outsourcing, by spending time thinking about not charging by the hour, but introducing a value-based pricing method. But that's a subject for another day. But yeah, it's money well spent.
Oh yeah. And the book is full of great advice. I got it a few months ago. I've read it. It's brilliant. I really do recommend it. And in your response there, Sarah, you did mention every day should be a good day. That was part of your response there. And that's actually bring us on to myth two. That was something else I wanted to speak to you about. So here's the myth. Every day should be a good day. And as you say in your book, whoever created this myth has a lot to answer for. And for me, putting an expectation on yourself that every day should be a good day filled with rabbits and rainbows, it's just a recipe for disaster, isn't it?
Yeah, it very much is. And yeah, clearly I haven't read my own book recently because I thought that was in the not being easy bit. But yeah, it's just holding up these feelings of, yes, I should be having success every day, and feeling that you're, I mean, this is when these feelings of kind of inadequacy kick in, and feeling like you're not doing as well as everyone else. And quite often what contributes to that is social media. It's really harmful because what social media tends to do is it tends to amplify where you're feeling, or at any given moment, any given day. If you're feeling strong and you're feeling like you're on it, you're achieving, you're ticking stuff off, you're doing what you want to do, you've got fulfillment in your life, you've got enjoyment within your career, you've got just every element of your work and every element of your life is reflected in how you're feeling in that moment. And then if you go onto social media, you'll start seeing the positives and thinking, okay, yeah, you know, I can compete in this sphere. We don't have to compete in that sphere. Every post you see on social media is, to a certain degree, a curated vision of that other person's life. We all are guilty of only putting out into the world what we want other people to see. It's carefully curated. I think it was, yes, it's a quote in the book. Anne Lamott said, don't compare your insides to someone else's outsides. So if you're comparing how you're feeling when you're at your very most vulnerable, you're feeling like, I mean, for starters, this is a huge subject. I was going to say you're feeling like you're a failure. For starters, don't beat yourself up. If something goes wrong, you're not a failure. You might have failed at that particular minute task, or even you might have messed up on a job. That doesn't make you a failure. That's describing yourself in such a negative way. And your brain has this tendency to listen to your negative self-talk, and it becomes escalated. So all the stuff about feeling like you need to be at your best all the time, it is really the reason why so many of us mask. I've got so much better at this. I've become way more aware of my own neurodiversity issues, for example. That's something I never would have talked about before, my own kind of deepest insecurities. But now I just think, if I can talk about things that help other people, talk about it in the book, this thing called a vulnerability loop. So if you're in a position where you're chatting to another freelancer and they're on the, oh yeah, everything's great, yeah, I'm busy, 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 all that, like, why not counter that with saying, well, actually, I've had a quiet couple of weeks. And yeah, you know what it's like. I've had a couple of worries about where the next job's coming from, but I know it always comes and whatever. And see, just by being vulnerable, you're giving the person you're talking to permission to do the same. And if they feel that they can open up and talk a little more about how things are real for them, that is when you start to make those real, genuine connections. And we all need those. So by putting out these perfect personas, personal brands, these masks of always being on it, always being professional, we're not being real, we're not being authentic, and we're not helping others. I think it's worth mentioning, actually, you read the subtitle of the book earlier on, Tried and Tested Tips to Help You Ace Self-Employment Without Burnout. And I feel like the word burnout gets bandied around a lot, and never more so than since COVID. Since we were all in that lockdown situation, facing working from home and facing the stress of being on our own or being surrounded by kids and pets and noise and how the hell do you focus? But actually, it's such an important thing. There is such a high prevalence of burnout, overwhelm leading to burnout in the freelance environment, that it's important we talk about these things, and it's normalizing them. It's not brushing them off. It's just making it easier for everyone to admit that these things touch them from time to time. However confident you are, however established you are, it's life.
Yeah, exactly. And in your response there, you mentioned failure as well, what that can do to you. And from my experience, the creative industry is one that, without any warning, it can make you feel like a bit of a failure. Like, every word that we write is reviewed, it's open to critique. Our work is in the spotlight a lot, and it has to please a lot of different minds. And I think for me, it's about accepting that failure is actually part of that process. I think failure is the wrong word, but you know that you're not going to get everything right first time. And that's really important just for protecting your mental health. And as you say, just that kind of stuff, that also contributes to burnout as well. So just being mindful that what you're alluding to there, Sarah, is that we see this picture perfect life of many people on social media, but it's curated. And we're all experiencing those kind of drawbacks and failures because that's just the nature of the industry we're working in, right?
Yeah, and I also think another challenge for us as copywriters is that we put our heart and soul into what we do. It's not like we're stacking shelves, nothing wrong with stacking shelves whatsoever, but it's not a heart and soul job. It's not giving of yourself. Any creative role like being a copywriter, we do put something of ourselves into everything we do. And yeah, like you say, it leaves us very open to criticism. And it's important to remember, I think, to take criticism professionally, not personally. It's quite a big thing to take on board. It's worth thinking about that. But it's not, you can't grow, you can't progress or develop without testing and measuring and failing. Failing is a springboard to success. I think it's Thomas Edison had 10,000 failed, I don't know if it's a true story or an urban myth, but 10,000 failed inventions before he invented the light bulb, something like that.
Oh, really? It's interesting.
So every failure just makes you think differently. It makes you more knowledgeable about what doesn't work.
Yeah, you're right. And just making me think, when I send a first draft to a client, I'd invite critique. So I'd say something like, I'm not emotionally attached to these birds, you know, and the shreds all you want. Give me your honest feedback on things. There is a little voice in the back of my head that's going, that's not true, is it, Tom? You are emotionally attached
that's
to these.
That's very brave.
And probably where a freelance copywriter, should we say, maybe is more susceptible to failure. It's in when you're sending that first draft to a client, it's scary as hell. It's still scary for me.
It's scary for me, 24 years on.
24 years.
Yeah, and but you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way, because when it stops being scary, it means you've stopped caring.
That's true. That is true. I like that. Yeah. Let's zoom in on that a bit. Let's say that failure is a client unhappy with your first draft, Sarah. I'm sure that's not the case. But do you have any strategies for not letting that feeling of failure getting in the way of pulling your sleeves up and just dealing with the feedback back in a logical way, not letting emotions get in there?
I am somebody that is very easily triggered by emotions and very I have big emotional responses to small things. So I am probably the last person you should be asking this question. I definitely think time can give perspective. I quite often have the knee-jerk reaction and will type the draft response, and then I have to force myself to sit on it and at least leave it overnight, sleep on it for one night at least, get some perspective, and perhaps go back to the client and say, I've safely received your comments. I'd like some time to think about this so I can respond thoughtfully, and take the time to remember that it is a one-off. Hopefully it's a rare instance of that happening. And it is about being considered. And I'm not somebody that finds it easy to be considered. It's not a natural state for me. I'm very like, bam, immediate, want to do the thing straight away. So if I get the email, I want to reply to the email straight away. So it is a question of creating some space in between receiving that email and responding. And then really putting it into perspective in your own mind. Don't dwell on it. Don't beat yourself up, and don't attribute the failure of one particular task. As I've already said, don't be careful with your self-talk. So if you're saying, oh, I'm such a failure, I'm in the wrong job, I shouldn't be doing this, I don't have the confidence, your brain does start to believe what you tell it. So all that negative self-talk, it really goes in. So be careful of the narrative. It's much more positive and powerful to say something like, okay, so obviously I'm disappointed that the client didn't like my work on this occasion, but I'm sure the work that comes out of this, being a more iterative process and incorporating feedback from the client, will make it a stronger and better job. And every time that happens, you have to see it as an opportunity for growth. I had it recently with a client who I hadn't worked with before. It's always that first job. When I've done the first job, I've got sending the first job to the client out the way. That's the danger zone for me. I send the work and I still get the butterflies. Gosh, what are they going to think? And 90% of the time they come back and go, absolutely what I wanted. You just got it. Brilliant. Very little feedback. And that's great. But just occasionally they will come back and say, okay, this really wasn't what I was expecting. And my defensive sort of natural, oh my God, I'm not good enough. I failed. That I have to keep in check. And then when I have the conversation with the client, they're not angry. They're not disappointed that they hired the wrong person. They just want it to be more of a collaborative process. And sometimes that can reflect the fact that the client is more hands-on, more used to micromanaging suppliers. I don't like being seen as a supplier. I don't think any freelance copywriter should. The dream scenario is to be considered as a partner, isn't it, with your clients on even terms. But yeah, take some space. Don't let it get inside your head. That's so much easier said than done. And I'm hopeless at that personally. But control the narrative in your own mind. Try to intentionally say, think of something really positive to counter. Okay, so this job, okay, so this isn't quite going as I'd hoped. However, over here, I had a brilliant discovery call with a new client and I'm excited to start work with them. Start to think of some positives to counterbalance it.
Yeah, I'm the same. You know, if I do get a disgruntled client, then I would tell them, I'll respond to you perhaps tomorrow once I've thought about what needs to happen here. And I think they appreciate that as well.
Definitely.
And also you've had time to kind of sit on that feedback. Hopefully by the next day, your emotions are not channeled into that reply to them anymore.
Yeah.
About it in a logical way. So I'm fully on board with that. Yeah, that's how I approach things as well. Sarah, before we move on to Name That Attraction, you've got to mention your other book, The Little Book of Confusables, which is really popular in the freelance world. I was just curious, are there any kind of top confusables? What would be like the top three confusables, do you think?
Do you mean top as in
most occurring?
Well, I can tell you that because I get the stats on my website. So I have blogs for a lot of the confusables that are in the book. So I get really high search traffic on let's versus let's, you know, let's with an apostrophe. Does it have an apostrophe or does it not have an apostrophe? Break and break.
Yeah. Okay.
I always think effect and effect, advise and advice, practice and practice, principle and principle, stationary and stationary. I always think that those are the most common, but the search traffic would say otherwise. And then the third one does tend to be practice or practice. And if you're listening in the US, there's no difference. They're both spelled the same. But in the UK, there, ICE is the noun and ISE is the verb.
All right, there you go, listener. There you go.
But I think also it's worth mentioning that I've had a few people say, oh my gosh, I wasn't expecting there to be so many random ones in here, like things that I never thought to look up. Like, oh, there is like things like Pacific and specific and some of the doggy dog world and damp squid and some of those kind of idiomatic phrases. But things like parameter and perimeter and, yeah, that's sort of more, can't think of another single random one, but rain and rain. That's one that a lot of people get wrong. And you don't think to look it up if you know it or you think you know it. Broach and broach and discreet and hoard. They're all homophones. And like I say, if you think you know it, you don't look it up. And then that's where the danger lies because, yeah, you could just be getting it wrong your whole life. So many people, so many professional copywriters and authors and PR people or whatever say, oh my God, I've spelt that wrong my entire life and I didn't know.
I'm just ordering that book as we speak.
It's fun. I think that's the best thing about it. The descriptions are fun and it's one of those desktop essentials.
Yeah, definitely. There you go. The Little Book of Confusables. Right. We're going to move on to our feature round, Name That Attraction. This is possibly the hardest name that attraction round of all time. And with every guest, we ask them to come up with a name and strapline for a new attraction coming to Brighton Pier. It's all fictional, of course. Sarah, my previous guest, Andrew Bolton, has set your attraction task, which is to come up with a name and strapline for Whack-A-Mole, which is already brilliant. So what have you got for us?
Hate him. That's even Bolton. God, no, he's a great guy. And yeah, I have to forgive him for this. But honest to goodness, I spent way too long deliberating this. I was like, oh, I've got to come up with something really clever. And then I just decided to keep it super simple. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, yeah, like I am a massive wildlife lover, a nature lover. So the idea of whacking a poor, a poor defenseless creature is kind of goes against the grain for me. Also, like kind of anti-violence as well. So this is a little bit of a, this is a bit of an odd one for me, but I was thinking, okay, so let's just keep the name simple, go with something that rhymes. What could it be? And I was like, yeah, okay, like came up with all these really overcomplicated ideas. And then I thought, oh, okay, what about trolling? Everybody's been trolled or experienced on behalf of someone that they care about really bad trolling online. And I just thought, I freaking hate internet trolls, keyboard warriors, hate it, hate those guys. So I just thought we'll call it Smack a Troll. Oh. So we'll have like little annoying looking little faces popping up. We can smack them over the head and the tagline is just going to be, it's time for revenge, dot, dot, dot.
I think you whacked it out of the park. Well done, Sarah.
Nicely done.
That was really challenging. You've done it. And also, and whilst you're here, would you like to set the new attraction task for my next guest, Ben McKinney?
Yes, I would. I remember Ben doing his first ever talk at a conference. He was brilliant. Yeah, so I'm going to go with what used to be little Sarah when I was a kid. Was always a bit of a weird kid. And we have, where I come from, Cirencester, they have this traveling fair that comes around first Monday of the month and the third Monday of the month in October, which is my birthday month. And it's called the Mop Fair. I don't know if that's a, is that a local thing? Probably it is. But they had the waltzers and I loved the waltzers. And I would always just loiter by the waltzers and hope I could just drag somebody on. I didn't really have many friends when I was growing up. And I just used to go on there and get such a dopamine buzz from being spun. They had, like, I've got to do this little silly accent now. They always have the guys who would stand on the back of your car and they'd go, scream if you want to go faster, girl. Scream if you want to go faster. And they would stand on the back of the car, spin you around, and I'd be like, spin off, spin off. And I'd get off like, I need to go again, again. And everybody would be like, no, like, once is enough. And I'd be just standing there waiting for some unsuspecting person I could grab on with me. So, yeah, the waltzers.
Okay. There you go, Ben. Your homework is set to name and strap lines for the waltzers. Awesome. Thanks, Sarah. And if people want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
Best place is go to my website, sarahtownsendeditorial.co.uk. It's got links to both of the books. It's got links to my blog, which has loads of freelance advice. It's got all the Confusables blogs. It's got more about the way I work, copy coaching, book coaching, if anybody is thinking of writing a business book for themselves. And it also links to all my social media.
Awesome. Well, I'll drop all the links in the show notes. You can find them there, listener. And thanks again, Sarah. And if you found this episode useful, do consider leaving a review for the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you want to join me for a chinwag about freelancing or copywriting, do drop me a line at coastalcopy.co.uk. And I'll see you next time on Podcast by the Pier. This episode of Podcast by the Pier is sponsored by Nick Ford Photography, based in Brighton. Now, they say a picture paints a thousand words, which is hard to accept as a copywriter. But when it comes to the brilliant work created by Nick and Michael, I have to concede. Based just by the level, 10 minutes from Brighton Station, these guys can take care of photography for your website, wedding, corporate events, and so much more. And if your order is over the value of £500, just use the word podcast with your inquiry to get 5% discount. Plus, 5% will also go to the Russell Martin Foundation. To learn more or to book a shoot, call 01273 683 867 or visit nickfordphotography.co.uk. And I'll see you next time on Podcast by the Pier.